Hi, this is Circe, and I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico. And this is our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam. Today I'm going to read a few stories, a few memories about the University of Maryland Munich campus. We have quite a lot of stories in folios in the museum library, and so for this podcast, I thought I would read a few snippets from some of our collections. Our museum has published 3 anthologies about the University of Maryland Munich. One is called Bavarian Cream, another is Noch Eins, and the last one, just published a couple of years ago, is Eins, Zwei, Zuffa. So I hope you enjoy some of these memories and can reminisce. So I'm going to read just a portion from an alum named John Falkenstein, and he writes to me about our book. So he wrote, "I just read your book about the University of Maryland in Munich. Sorry, there are no secret tunnels, but in the basement of the former commissary there is a sub-basement, and in this basement there are 2 emergency hatches into the sewer system. And yes, there were some great beer joints outside the concern. The high school track cross-country team got caught in one. They would jog out of sight, cross Tegernseer Landstrasse, and then have pizza and beer. It was not a successful cross-country team, but they did have a very good time. As an army brat born in Maastricht in 1949, I came to Munich in 1965 and graduated in 1968 from the high school. I was very much a gearhead and quite independent, as are all of my brothers and sisters, probably because we grew up in Europe. Before coming to Munich, we lived in Paris, and I routinely wandered all over all by myself, riding the metro system or using my bicycle. I had quite a work ethic, so summer vacations were spent visiting the grandparents in Maastricht and working. In 1967, my junior year, I had enough credits to graduate, and I was 1A and tried to leave school in my senior year, and in the end basically just showed up to pick up my diploma. By then, I already worked as a busboy at the McGraw-Casern Officers Club, and I also scrubbed dishes, polished floors, and took care of the setup for the University of Maryland Dining Hall. Perhaps because the Army felt that I and some of the others should have been in uniform, we were assigned some of the worst cleanup work during the summer, cleaning up putrefying pig carcasses north of Munich. During my high school senior year, I was hired through Walter Lubinsky at the University of Maryland, and I ran and managed the language lab. I was seriously fluent in German, Dutch, and French, so I was the perfect person for pronunciation lessons. The students could be very rowdy, and I remember coming to work once and finding mashed potatoes stuck to the ceiling in the dining hall. I spent the better part of a day scraping it off, and Sergeant Battaglia, who also ran the officers' club, was furious. The dining hall was closed for 2 days as punishment. I started attending the university and also worked the language lab and worked at the used bookstore, and I worked at the Army and Air Force Exchange headquarters when they moved on to McGraw-Casern. So that is John's memory of a little bit of his time at the University of Maryland. And he says, sorry, there are no secret tunnels. But Keith Patton has some other memories about the tunnels or the not tunnels at the University of Maryland. So this is Keith. Tales of the tunnels on the Casern abound. The truth, the tunnels were nothing more than utility corridors for running the electric and hot water lines from the coal plant beneath the tower in the center of the Casern. The lights in the tunnels were on long strings, maybe 50 yards or so. I recall my roommate and I entered one of the tunnels beneath the building in which the Special Services Theater was located. We entered through a window and then went down into the tunnels themselves. I cannot accurately state how deep they were, but by my reckoning, they had to be deeper than the McGraw-Graben, also known as the Sunken Autobahn, since we ended up in the bottom of the zoology building. I recall as we explored, we would turn on a string of lights, then turn them off at the other end. I suddenly realized that the lights were coming on again behind us about two sets back. Either it was another group of intrepid students, or it was the MPs or somebody else patrolling the tunnels. We did not hang out to find out. We did not hang around to find out. We increased our pace and, as I said, ended up on the classroom side of the caserne from where we started. I don't know exactly where we crossed under the Autobahn, and to be honest, I don't recall where the roadbed started down, so we may have crossed over somewhere past the motor pool. It seemed like we were in the tunnels for quite a while, but I have no idea how far we might have gone or in what direction. I had been told, and for years, I believed the caserne was a German military base during the war. However, upon doing a bit of research, it turns out the caserne and the old dorms were accommodation blocks for workers of the Reichszeugmeisterei, what we would call the Reichsquartermaster Ministry. They were responsible first for standardizing the uniforms worn by the brown shirts and later the Hitler Youth and the Schutzhafeln, or the SS, or other party organizations. The organization was responsible for contracts, procurements, and oversight of uniform and equipment manufacturing in Germany. The main building was what became the APHIS building across the Autobahn, after the Reichseagle and swastika was removed from the building's facade, of course. Evidence of the quartermaster service is evident in the bas-reliefs over the doors on the Autobahn side of Bouvier Hall. They depict workers doing work on textiles and other skilled labor. There was another unit housed on the caserne, such as the Reichsautozeug Deutschland and other automobile platoons that served as the motor pool for the Nazi Party in Munich and also provided support for the mass rally events with such things as loudspeakers and film crews. They were essentially functioning as roadies for the local Nazi Party rallies. So, I am not sure what this does to claims of ghostly SS troopers wandering the tunnels and attics. There still might be truth to the claims that SS lapel pins were found by students in the basement and drain pipes, or they could all be chalked up to the campus equivalent of urban legends. What I found more interesting is the facility just down the road on Peter Ausingerstrasse, hidden behind a forbidding concrete wall, Stadelheim Prison. Hitler himself was imprisoned there in 1922 for assault. If you are up on your Nazi Party history, you will be familiar with an event called the Night of the Long Knives, also known as Romputsch. When Hitler staged a purge of the Nazi brown shirt leaders, his only rivals for power, and replaced them with his own SS, the leaders were imprisoned in Stadelheim Prison just down the street. They did not stay very long, but were executed on Hitler's orders. Ernst Röhm and Peter von Heidebreck were two, but many more lower functionaries were executed by firing squad in the prison. Röhm and Heidebreck were shot in their cells. The prison was the scene of at least one guillotine execution during the war for violation of the racial purity law. Many members of the anti-Nazi German resistance were executed there, and a member of the Red Army faction hung herself in her cell in 1977. Who knew so much history was just a short walk down the street? Kathy Paxton Williams was at the University of Maryland in 1982 and 1983, and she remembers some of the bomb threats that happened. When you hear the term bomb threat, what usually comes to mind? Terrorism, fear, doom, possible destruction or explosions. Well, yeah, those make sense. As I settled into my apartment in Bouvier at the beginning of the 1982-83 school year, I was startled by a bomb threat one night. Fire drills were one thing, but a bomb threat? We went outside and shivered for a while before they let us back into the dorm. Through the course of the year, bomb threats became a fairly regular event. Bouvier residents knew what to do. We prepped little bags that held essential items, passport, ID, some money, a bit of food, and a warming beverage. So when the bomb threat alarm went off, I'd grab that bag plus the down comforter and pillow off the bed, bundle up to go outside and make a party of it with my friends, or perhaps just huddle together for warmth. We in Bouvier presumed that most of these threats were pranks phoned in by students in the off-base dorms. This was made quite clear when the final threat was less distinct. It said there was a bomb in a university dorm, so all the dorms had the alarm. The Bouvier residents were pros by this time, but this was a new experience for the off-base dorm residents. They went out in their pajamas or light sweats. They were shivering. They had no ID and in some cases no shoes. We took mild pity upon them. This last threat lasted so long that they opened up the school building so we could find a place to crash. My boyfriend and I found a couple of chairs in the museum on the second floor. As I recall, that was the final bomb threat of the year. Perhaps the people from the other dorms finally realized they weren't so funny after all. A later alum, Eddie Bell, recalls his developing friendships at the University of Maryland over cans of Spam and bags of rice. He says, "I was born in Mobile, Alabama, raised behind the Berlin Wall, and graduated from high school in Stuttgart, Germany. I always felt I had a strange life since I was born in America but spent the majority of my life in Germany. When I graduated, I actually considered Germany my homeland. I'd attended some college in the U.S., but I returned back home to attend the University of Maryland Munich campus. It was August 1988. I was both excited and anxious. I had a pretty good roommate. He was a quiet guy. He was a little clumsy but had aspirations to play basketball, and he was pretty good at it. Through our interactions, I learned he loved tennis shoes, Jordans, like me. We also shared similar interests in music. The greatest thing, however, was that he introduced me to my best friend, Joe. Culturally speaking, we were totally different, but after many nights of hanging out in our dorm rooms talking, and eventually we're eating meals together, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We talked about everything. We both loved hip-hop music. My pops taught me the art of DJ. Joe could beatbox and rap. He would record sounds over cassette tapes and loop them over each other and make songs. We were always cracking jokes. It seemed that he was always right about anything we discussed, and to this day, I have to say he pretty much always is, even yet. He just had a unique way of looking at things. I used to hate how he wanted to look at all sides of an argument, even if he didn't believe in it. We had a brotherly love where we would crack jokes on each other, call each other ridiculous names, hang out, and even do our homework together. That was life in 88-89 Munich, Germany. Then things gradually started to change. I knew when it started. I was sitting with Joe as he was looking at a girl. He kept telling me how wonderful she was. I could tell he was taken by her and wondered to myself, why doesn't he just talk to her? Well, he did, and that was the beginning of the end. At first she had a quarter of his time and I had three, and then it was half for her and half for me. As time slowly passed, I started to realize that she now had three quarters of his time while I had one. I was watching my best friend, my family there in Munich, slowly exit my life. At least that's how it felt. It got to the point where we'd see each other in the hallways and just say, "Hey, what's up, man?" Reminiscing how Joe and I met started me thinking why we connected so well. Was it because my roommate knew Joe first? I don't believe so. I think it all started when Joe stopped by while I was having an afternoon snack and noticed I was eating Vienna sausages. He couldn't believe that, especially since he knew most people were embarrassed to admit that they eat any canned meats. We laughed and shared stories about growing up eating Vienna sausage, potted meat, corned beef, and the mother of all canned meats, Spam. In fact, my standard grocery list always had smoked oysters, a couple cans of Spam, some cans of Vienna sausages, and a bag of rice. I told him how I had been eating those foods my whole life and how my pops introduced me to the delicacy of saltine crackers and Vienna sausages. We shared stories of the meals our parents had prepared for us, and we shared more stories of our culture and life experiences. That was the beginning of our friendship, which to me turned to family gathering time as we shared dinners of Spam and rice 2 or 3 times a week. The University of Munich campus was where it all began as we talked and broke bread together. The last little snippet I'm going to read was written by Felix Rogers, and he talks about the bobcats. Now, when I was in Munich in 79 and 80, we had the lizards. And now, this is much later, in the late 80s, there were the bobcats. And so Felix wrote a little bit about how the bobcats came to be. But the part I'm going to read is after they've been given the blessing to become an official fraternity, and they were given the requirement of outlining an internal structure and set up for the first line of initiates, and they had to have the Greek council approve their group. He talks about in their first meeting. In our first meeting as an official fraternity, we discussed what we wanted to do with our first line of initiates. We wanted an initiation process that was going to bring attention to our group, to foster unity, and most importantly, make the founders laugh. Once we came up with the process, we met with the first line of 7 initiates and told them that at any moment rush could start, so they should be ready. On a Thursday night, we got the founders together at 2 a.m. and assigned them each an initiate to wake up and to bring back to Elkins Hall so we could start the process. We pushed through doors and screamed at the new initiates, "Rush is starting! Get your butt out of bed and bring a pair of underwear with you." We lined them up and told them the process would last a couple of weeks. We grabbed the extra pair of underwear they brought with them and smeared a melted Hershey bar in the crack of the underwear. Each member had to wear the underwear for the duration of the initiation. If we caught them not wearing their underwear any time they stepped out in public, they were dropped from our line. Plus, they had to get at least 50 signatures from girls on their underwear. If a girl kissed the underwear, leaving a lipstick print that had to be witnessed by a founding member, that would count as 5 signatures. When our guys went to class the next morning, the entire school was buzzing about the underwear bit. It was a stroke of genius by Raphael and Tim. This last snippet comes from 1989. And it discusses a little bit about one of the trips that the University of Maryland Munich basketball team went on. And this time, the match was in Prague. So this again is from Felix Rogers. Each year, our premier game was against a team from the University of Prague. One semester they would come to Munich to play our team, and the next semester we would take a 4-hour bus ride to Prague to play this team. When I joined the team, I was told how important this game was. My first semester they arrived at Munich to play us, I looked at this completely unimpressive group of 40-plus-year-olds. I thought for sure we would run these guys off the court. What I didn't know is that they were members of the chemistry department at Prague that had played together for about 20 years. Their passes were crisp, the ball didn't hit the floor, and the shots seemed to all go in. Our best players, Ed, Lorenzo, and Dan, played their asses off, but we couldn't stop these old pros. If the team needed offense off the bench, that was Raphael, and he couldn't get his shot off. If we needed defense, that was me. I watched a 45-year-old chemistry professor shoot jumper after jumper in my face and then turned around to start playing defense before the ball hit the net. And it did go through the net, often. He was that sure of his shot. They blew us out. The next semester, we went to Prague. The game was a bit closer, but these old bastards still beat us. The team really enjoyed ourselves in Prague. We were a group of brash, ballsy Americans in our early 20s. We traveled with 12 players, 2 team managers, and a coach. After our bus dropped us off at the University of Prague, we were told to stay on campus and not to leave because it was extremely dangerous around the city. They were right in the middle of the Czechoslovakian Revolution of 1989. I'm not sure why University of Maryland Munich thought this was an appropriate trip, especially with the group they were sending. After hearing the warning, we waited for the coach to fall asleep, grabbed four taxis, and went right into the heart of Prague. After a great meal, we left the restaurant and started walking around downtown. Then we noticed people starting to stare at us. We started walking a bit faster. Lorenzo was yelling at a guy that was yelling at us. A crowd started to form, so we all took off running at full speed. We ran down into an underground train station and back up the other side. As we looked back down the street, a riot was underway. We got into cabs and headed back to campus. Lesson learned. The next day, our coach took the group on a sightseeing trip around Prague. The city was a mixture of abject poverty and beautiful historical architecture. It was eye-opening to see both the beauty and the poverty of a country in transition. Along with more warnings about being safe as we split up to start shopping, our translator guide told us to be careful of people trying to swindle you out of your American currency. The exchange rate at the time was 45 crowns to one US dollar. Be aware, if offered more than the current exchange rate, it could be problems. After a couple of hours of shopping and sightseeing, a member of the basketball team ran back to the group and mentioned he had just found somebody that gave him 60 to 1. It was such a great deal. He gave the guy 200 US dollars. We left the shopping area for a team lunch and we found a really nice restaurant that brought out food in waves. When the waitress brought out the bill, Sam, feeling like he was a big deal, grabbed the check and said, "I got this." He pulled out all his colorful money, and the waitress looked at it and threw it back at him and said in English, "This not crown, this Polish money." And I believe that the team learned its lesson yet again. So the University of Maryland brings so many memories to students. And although the stories I've read have been very different, and there are a lot of stories about the shenanigans that the students got themselves into. Most of the alums say they got an incredible education there. A historic campus in the heart of Munich, in Europe, with dedicated professors and staff members who loved being in Europe, who loved working for the university, who loved their jobs, and who were some of the finest instructors in the world. And so for a young American kid growing up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Europe, Munich was a magical place. And these stories and the hundreds of other stories that we have in our archive and in the three anthologies really show how lucky we were to go to the cobblestone campus, as it is sometimes called. So I hope you enjoyed this little series of stories, little snippets, and when you have an opportunity, check out other podcasts on our site. Come to the museum. And I hope you have really enjoyed a little walk down memory lane. Bye-bye.